We have been talking about church history. We've kind of come through the initial phase of the Reformation, and then sort of the second phase of the Reformation was the spread of the Reformation around the European continent and the British Isles. So we talked about how it spread to France, how it spread to Scandinavia, how it spread to the British Isles last week. And now we're going to talk a little bit about some of the conflict that resulted as the Reformation spread and as there is a fair bit of reaction to the Reformation. So specifically what we're going to try to do is talk about Germany and the 30 Years' War, France and the Huguenots, and then England and Puritanism. And one of the things that we need to remember is that we look back on the Protestant Reformation, and mostly what we do is say, praise the Lord, hallelujah. And it's easy to kind of romanticize it. It's easy to kind of think about the Protestant Reformation and just be so very grateful, and we should be very grateful for the Protestant Reformation. However, it did start multiple wars, some of them very long and very bloody. And, you know, of course, there's probably multiple ways to look at that. Some might would say, Protestants would say, well, if the Catholics would have just left us alone, we would have been happy to leave them alone. And I'm sure Catholics at the time were saying, if they wouldn't have stirred up this trouble, we wouldn't have had to go in and start various wars. But those wars had consequences in the world of religion and ideas. And that's one of the reasons that we're going to kind of talk about this. So, here we go. Germany and the 30 Years' War. So, the Peace of Augsburg was kind of a truce, right? And it put an end to the religious wars of the 1500s. But it was destined to be short. It was destined to not last because it stated that Catholic territories were to remain Catholic and Protestant territories were to remain Protestant. However, Protestant or Lutheran ideas just continued to spread kind of under the surface, even in the Catholic areas. And so more and more people are, you know, from our perspective, more and more people are getting saved. More and more people are coming to understand grace, salvation by grace through faith. More and more people are coming to understand the authority of the Scriptures. And so, you know, the ideas of the Reformation are spreading in these territories where essentially you can't be a Protestant, you can't be a Lutheran, you had to continue to go to the Catholic Church. So this led to a renewed state of war in the 1600s. And also because the emperor was constantly looking for a way to reestablish Catholicism in the Holy Roman Empire, which is more than just Germany, but it seems to be very central there in Germany. There were constant maneuverings, constant intrigues, and consequently, the Protestants banded together. So even though the Lutherans and the Calvinists, or the Lutherans and the Reformed in that part of the world, did not see eye to eye on many things, and as you can remember, Luther and Zwingli argued, you know, I started to say violently, I mean, not physically violently, but they argued vehemently against one another. They wrote these books and called each other terrible, terrible names, which was kind of the style of writing back then. Nevertheless, sort of the second generation or even the third generation of reformers or those following the original reformers, they saw the need to just in a military sense, an organizational sense, they came together. And so they banded together for their own protection, and there was constant war for 30-plus years. One example of the devastation would be in the German area, the Bohemian region. The population of Bohemia was apparently, at least some claim, was reduced by four-fifths. That would be from migration because of warfare in the area as well as just devastation, people dying of bullets and disease, swords and disease. So very, very devastating time of terrible, terrible war. Eventually, 1648, there is what's called the Peace of Westphalia. The Peace of Westphalia. And this extended basically kind of two ideas, freedom of religion and the secular state. And so we, in many ways, are the heirs of the Peace of Westphalia because we live in a secular state. There is no state religion, and part of the governing power of the state is not through the church. So this really is begun in Western civilization at the Peace of Westphalia, 1648. So it gave religious freedom not only to the princes, but also to their people. So do you remember, wasn't it just last week that we talked about how religious freedom in the Holy Roman Empire meant that the prince, the nobility, they could choose what their religion was going to be, and all their people had to follow them. And so if you had a Catholic prince, you had to be a Catholic. If you had a Protestant prince, you had to be a Protestant. That's what quote-unquote religious freedom meant earlier than this. Now religious freedom means that you may be different from your prince. So both the princes and the people have religious freedom after the Peace of Westphalia. However, they only had three choices, and that was Catholic, Lutheran, or Reformed. So that meant, remember all the Anabaptists, many of whom were slaughtered. I mean, just a terrible, terrible, terrible persecution against Anabaptists. They do not have the freedom to worship according to their conscience. So, and I'm assuming that the reasons for that are because many of them were pacifists and they were considered radicals. So if you're not willing to defend the state, they didn't want you around, basically. So those were the three options there. However, property, so church buildings, reverted back to whoever had held them in 1624. So that was just some line of demarcation, basically. There were, so that meant that the property went back to what, you remember how there were regions that were Catholic and regions that were Protestant? So the church properties went back to sort of correlate to those properties. And as I've already mentioned, this is basically the beginning of the modern secular state with some idea of the separation of church and state. Any questions so far? Or comments?
I think they were getting it right. They weren't compromising doctrine. They were saying, look, this kind of separatist tie between church and state.
Right.
I would imagine the primary cause of war is sacred, you know, church and state.
Yes.
And that war in this country is that too many religious wars are killing each other separate wars. I mean, this tie to church and state is a problem.
Yes, because you have the power of the state enforcing church laws. It is definitely a problem.
So if the Democrats were to give us a hard time if they get back in here, which they probably will, I mean, can this Peace of Westphalia be of any point of
any help for us? I would recommend that we go back to the Constitution. It's because who's going to know what we're talking about if we talk about the Peace of Westphalia? Recently, I read a couple of articles about immigration. And remember in the book of Hebrews it talks about entertaining strangers. And so there's, you guys know the word Philadelphia, because philos or phileo means brotherly love. In the Greek, that word, entertain strangers, is xenophilos, which means loving those that are different from us. So I studied a little bit about immigration, and really the Peace of Westphalia is the beginning of when states had the power to control their borders and could control, at least to some degree, could control immigration. So it was more of a, instead of having an empire where you could move all over the place, you had individual states who, at least to some degree, attempted to control their borders. And essentially, conservatives in the West go back to the Peace of Westphalia to defend a state or nation-state controlled immigration, as opposed to sort of empirical, you can just go anywhere you want to, kind of thing. So that was another sidebar on the Peace of Westphalia. Well, let me kind of draw us to this little quotation that is in italics here. So the events of all of this warfare began to lead to an attitude of doubt regarding convictions, religious convictions. So people are basically saying, if religious convictions held strongly leads to wars like this one, then we don't want any part of strongly held religious convictions. So this is a quote from the textbook I've been using by Justo Gonzalez. Could any doctrine be true that produced the atrocities of the 30 Years' War? Was there not a more tolerant, more profound, and even more Christian way to serve God than simply following the dictates of orthodoxy, be it Catholic or Protestant? Now, this is not his opinion. I mean, he obviously is a Christian and holds Christian doctrine to be very dear. But nevertheless, he is saying that the attitude of the European people, especially in Germany, but we will see how this spreads in other places as well, begin to move towards something else. We seem to not be able to rule society through religious doctrine. So consequently, there must be a different answer. And so there's a lot of doubt. This is an age, one of the chapter headings was an age of doubt and dogma. So this, you know, sort of such strong defense, military defense of doctrine led towards great doubt of those doctrines. We can move to France unless anybody has a question or a comment. We can go to France and talk. We can talk about France, France and the Huguenots. All right, so let's talk about France. The monarchs of France basically tolerated the Protestants in the early 1600s as long as they didn't have concentrated power. So we talked about this last week. They basically banned them from Paris. They banned them from other sort of power centers or avenues of power. However, by the time we get to King Louis the 14th, he's known as the Sun King, so this is a high water mark of really the glory of the monarchy of France. He desired to stamp out Protestantism. So he began with mild pressures, and then he moved towards stronger threats and pressures, eventually to violence and forced conversions. So the terminology for this was reunification. So to convert back to the Catholicism, all you had to say was, I reunify. I reunite with the old Catholic Church. That's all that you were saying. And many, many Protestant Christians were tortured. And that's all that they had to say in the heat of torture was, I reunify. And they would have been set free. The torture would have ended. And very, very few of them did. They were a strong-hearted group of people who resisted. However, tens of thousands did reconvert back. Some of them, however, secretly held their Protestant convictions. So the distinction I'm trying to draw here is many people did it without ever being tortured. If they were strong enough to get to the torture chamber, very few of them did deny their faith. Some of them reunified in words and on the outside, but on the inside, they continued to hold their Protestant convictions, and they would meet secretly in fields and in the woods. And because of this, these secret Protestants, not only are they known as Huguenots, that's a fairly well-known term that we've talked about before, but they also became known as the Church of the Desert because they met outside, they met in the wilderness. They were became known as the Church of the Desert. In 1685, the king, Louis XIV, issued something called the Edict of Fontainebleau, and it made it illegal to be a Protestant in France. And so there was a mass exodus of Huguenots at this point. They went to all over the world, really. Switzerland, Germany, England, the Netherlands, and North America. There's a Huguenot influence here in our United States, as well as Canada. However, many of those who left were middle-class people. And so they took with them their capital. They took with them their skills. And some believe that this mass exodus of wealth and of, you know, skill is directly responsible for the French Revolution, because at that point you had primarily nobility who expected, you know, a cushy life because of taxation of the people, and you had poor people who had, you know, small skills, very little skills, and no way to earn money, so they get increasingly taxed more and more and more to support this kind of top-heavy nobility system, and all of that led to the French Revolution. Now, I'm sure that's probably an oversimplification, but nevertheless, a contributing factor to the French Revolution. Eventually, those Protestants who were not leaving turned to armed rebellion, so some of them kind of radicalized. So you remember how the Anabaptists radicalized in Germany? They predicted the end of the world. They predicted the coming of Christ, and then they took up arms. So the same thing kind of happens there in France. Predictions of apocalypse, and then eventually they decided to bring the apocalypse and started a war, in a sense. They took up arms. It was more of a guerrilla warfare type rebellion, only a few hundred soldiers, but they kept the French army of 25,000 fully occupied. Because, you know, how guerrilla warfare works, you go in, you harass them, you go back and blend into the population, and they can't find you. So, ultimately, because the army could not defeat them, they figured out what regions or what villages they were using as bases, and they went basically and burned those villages down. They razed 500-plus villages and hamlets as a way of trying to destroy, to beat down this rebellion. Eventually, this isn't in the notes, but eventually the rebellion just died down because they bled it to death by killing off not only those that they could find, but these villages where they were based, their families, their farms. And they finally captured the last few leaders and killed them, slaughtered them. But they held on there to the end, faithful to the faith. This is a big jump in time, but persecution of Protestants continued on until 1787, when King Louis XVI, so the grandson of King Louis XIV, he decreed religious tolerance. However, like Germany, these struggles, this ongoing warfare, caused the population in general to doubt doctrinal convictions and dogmatism. So there's just kind of a, you know, man, if that's where this takes us, we just don't want to go there. Any comments or questions?
Did France ever recover spiritually after this?
So we're going to comment a little bit on this, but I mean, if you think about more modern history, you start to think of Germany as kind of the root of you know, philosophical doubt and the kind of the Enlightenment and the tearing down of any real foundation, what we might call foundationalism, you know, that we can actually know something. And so in many ways, not only did these nations embrace a secular state, secularism became the religion. Yeah. So that is pretty much what we see in Europe, that secularism is their religion. So I don't know for sure. Like, I know that in France, Muslim women cannot wear the hijab. And I think that in like public schools, Christian men and women cannot wear a cross pendant. I could be wrong about that, but it's like you can be as religious as you want to, but keep it private. Keep it private. So that demarcation between public and private expression is very, very strong there. So, anything else about France and the Huguenots? All right, let's talk about the Puritans in England. And this is a little closer to our heritage because obviously our governmental system is inherited from England. And a lot of our sort of social structures as well. So remember back to Queen Elizabeth. Right, so there was a lot of struggle and strife and bloodletting, right, under Mary Tudor and Mary Stuart. Eventually we get Elizabeth on the throne in England, and her plan was this sort of moderate reformation. So she wanted the Church of England to be moderate. She did not want Catholics to be allowed, but she also did not want the more radical reformers to be given free rein as well. And you'll kind of see why, if you understand the Puritans, they would have had church buildings that did not have any of the pomp and circumstance that so much of the population was accustomed to. And it would have been, in her opinion, it would have just been too much. And they were already kicking back at the divine right of kings. So we're going to kind of get to the idea of divine right of kings as we go on down through this. But you do remember, right, that John Knox referred to the Jezebel rulers in the British Isles and in Europe. So there was Mary of Guise in France, I think, at the time. And then you had Mary Tudor, you had Mary Stuart, and then eventually you have Elizabeth. He would have liked Elizabeth, but he had already written the book, right? Okay, and the damage was done. And so she is, you know, she rules for a long time, but she pushes back against the Puritan element, the more conservative Reformation element, because she doesn't think she doesn't trust them, and she thinks that they would dethrone her if they could, or they would change the church so much that it would, you know, kind of evacuate some of her power. So, this middle ground is the Church of England. It's Anglicanism. And when she died in 1605, she left no direct heir. So she named James VI of Scotland. So he's King of Scotland, James VI. She names him as her successor, and he becomes James I of England. So he is now ruling what is not technically a United Kingdom. He is a king of two kingdoms. He's the king of Scotland and of France. But eventually it does become the United Kingdom. But he also has continuous conflicts with those that had not thought the Reformation went far enough. And so what's kind of going on here is he wants an absolute monarchy like they have in France. And he believed that the only way to get that was to have a strong hierarchical church. So you do that through bishops. You have the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he tells all of his bishops, and all of his bishops tell their parishioners, their pastors, what to preach. And he basically says, you must tell from the top down, King, Archbishop of Canterbury, the various regional bishops, and then to the pastors, you must preach the divine right of kings. So he needs a strong hierarchical church for this to happen. And of course, he's constantly got these Puritan types pushing back against that and not wanting they don't believe that there should be bishops at all, really, or at least that they're not required. So these Puritans, some of them believed a variety of different things. So some of the Puritans believe that in the Bible there are multiple ways of doing church government. And although the Episcopalian hierarchical system would be allowed. It's not required. Others of them were more Presbyterian, and they believed that churches were to be ruled by elders and by collective elders. So we've talked about the Presbyterian system. You have a synod, and that synod is made up of elders from the different churches, and they make the bigger decisions, the denominational decisions together. And then you have people who are independents. They believe that all churches should be independent and autonomous. And some of these believed in only baptizing believing adults, and they were called Baptists. So, hello to our Baptists here today. So, our heritage, I grew up in Baptist churches. We are a Baptistic church here. So, our Baptistic heritage flows to this fountain. Our Baptistic heritage does not really flow to the Anabaptist heritage. So that Anabaptist heritage, for one thing, they didn't even start out with immersion. And they were much more radical than we would want to go. That Anabaptist heritage from the continent of Europe really flows to the United States through the Mennonites, the Amish, and the Brethren. And maybe some other groups just don't come to my mind. But the Amish, they're, you know, the Amish don't have a pastor. They sit and meditate until someone is given an inner light. And then they speak from that inner light and then they dismiss. That more fluid, less dependence on the scriptures, if any dependence upon the scriptures, that is what, you know, Anabaptism led to. This stream of the Baptists is really where our heritage comes from. Although these Baptists probably were Presbyterian types who became to biblical convictions about baptizing believers only through immersion, by hearing about the Anabaptist, okay, they knew something about them, and so there's some influence, but there's a merging of influence, and that's kind of where our more modern-day Baptists, I think, would come from. You're having this sort of denominational splintering in England. Because King James, this is the second dark bullet point, because King James and the leading theologians of the Anglican Church, they really loved the high church beauty of worship in the Anglican Church, which they had inherited from the Catholics. Because they appreciated and enforced that, so there were different times when you were required as an Anglican pastor to use the Common Book of Prayer and to use the liturgy. You couldn't branch off and preach a series on Ephesians if you wanted to. Okay? Because they were at times required to do that, the Puritan element saw all of this as a movement back towards Catholicism. And they're always pushing back against any tendency to move back there. So this is, we're talking about 100 years since the Reformation. This is recent memory. This is a real possibility. France has gone back and forth and back and forth and back and forth between Protestantism and Catholicism, and they don't want to see that happening, and so they're constantly pressing back against any movement that they see as a return to Catholicism. King James's personal character did not help matters. He was a homosexual, although he was also married and had an heir. But nevertheless, he was a homosexual, and he showered on his favorites court positions, power, and wealth. So if you can imagine, you know, the most strict, you know, holiness kind of people, these Puritans, you know, knowing that their king, that they're presently resisting, is a homosexual, it's just, you know, one more log on the fire for all that they kind of hate about what he is trying to do. Now, his son, Charles I, continued his policies. after he took the throne. In 1633, under Charles I, the Archbishop of Canterbury began persecuting the Puritans. So this is Protestants persecuting Protestants, because these Protestants are too Protestant. Okay? And they're always pushing back against him. But so the Archbishop of Canterbury begins persecuting the Puritans because he wants to enforce unity in the Church of England. He wants there to be this unified religion to support King Charles. So the Archbishop of Canterbury was a favorite of King Charles I, and he kind of got him placed in that position. His measures included multiple things. They did include the death penalty for leadership. It also included orders of mutilation. So people would get their tongues cut out and their ears cut off. And perhaps other things, but we're going to get to Oliver Cromwell in a little bit. But especially during the time leading up to the Civil War, people were getting these orders of mutilation because they were hearing Protestant preaching, or they were speaking Reformation things. They were speaking against the king, or listening to someone against the king. Many years ago, as a teenager, I watched a movie about Oliver Cromwell, and one of the more dramatic points is when he comes face to face with one of his servants who has had their ears cut off because of their insurrectionist tendencies. Of course, it's just a movie, but that kind of thing would influence you, right? If you knew people that had happened to. Both James before him and Charles I needed Parliament to be able to raise revenue. They needed to be able to... The power of the purse was with Parliament, as it is with our Congress. However, Parliament, especially the House of Commons, was increasingly controlled by the Puritans. And this is kind of interesting. Charles I would find someone loyal to him in the House of Commons, and he would reward them by making them a lord, which put them in the House of Lords, which means that he was only decreasing his support in the House of Commons, which is where all the rabble-rousers were, and what he especially needed to control. And he was kind of shooting himself in the foot, which he did repeatedly. He repeatedly did things that were stupid if he really wanted to stay on the throne. However, these Puritans refused to raise any taxes for the government without dealing with some of their priorities. So they wanted to deal with the power of the crown compared to their power. They wanted some assurances that we were never going back, or they were never going back to Catholicism, and so they just wouldn't raise any money. And King Charles was unwilling to deal with these things, so he repeatedly convened a parliament and disbanded it. Convened a parliament and disbanded it. And he was constantly hoping, well, this time, maybe, the mix of the election will change enough that they'll vote me some tax money. But it never worked. And they constantly saw Charles's maneuverings as pushing towards Catholicism, and the fact that the Queen was celebrating Mass privately. If I remember correctly, was she from Spain? I don't think she was from England, if I remember correctly, and she had come from a Catholic territory. So she was privately celebrating Mass, and that doesn't help matters. You know, so you've got these guys that are just rising up, you know, basically, because of his tendencies, and then she adds fuel to the fire by remaining Catholic. So eventually all of this tension boils over in civil war. Again, we see these religious kinds of wars. Some troops were loyal to the crown, but Parliament raised their own army. Oliver Cromwell, who had come to these more Puritan convictions. He wasn't born into them, in other words. He had come to them. Raised a cavalry to field against the king's cavalry. So if you can imagine, the king's power base is in the nobility. They are the ones that can afford horses and equipment. So the king's strength is in the cavalry. And now, what are you going to do? Because the cavalry is like tanks against the infantry. And so you had to find a way for the common people to build a cavalry. And so Cromwell leads that charge. If I remember correctly, he goes back to his home and recruits an army, and he fields them on horseback at his own expense. He was quite a wealthy man. And because of their initial successes and his own sort of charismatic leadership style, his own enthusiasm was contagious, the cavalry grows, and the people, the Parliament's army begins to win repeatedly, and eventually the king's army is defeated at the Battle of Naseby, and the king was captured. He was tried for treason and beheaded. So it was quite a tumultuous time. We don't have time to go into all of that. It was a long trial and quite a traumatic time for England to chop off the head of their king. So this led to a time called the Protectorate, where Oliver Cromwell becomes the Lord Protector, and he could, Parliament couldn't get along with each other. They didn't have a common enemy anymore, right? Charles is dead. We don't have a king. So the Parliament can't get along with each other, and the Parliament as a whole can't get along with Cromwell. And so Cromwell marches in. Remember, he's kind of the general. He marches in, and he kicks them all out and locks the door. So he disbands Parliament, like the king had been doing, and he names himself the Lord Protector. And he enacted several Puritan reforms. So religiously, he was relatively tolerant. He was, although himself an independent, felt like churches should be independent and autonomous, he allowed for a hierarchical bishopric, if that's what some regions wanted, or if what a particular denomination wanted. He also allowed for a more Presbyterian style of church government, as well as an independent style of church government. So he was tolerant regarding that. He also tried to reform society, so laws were enacted that regulated what you could do on the Lord's Day, and other frivolities such as horse racing, cockfighting, and the theater. So those things came to be kind of regulated, and many people rebelled against that. They did not care for or like these sort of strict, more puritanical kinds of laws. So when I think of the Puritans, I think of their theology. I think of their devotedness, their pursuit of holiness. I think of their church reforms, how to do church. One of the earliest books I ever read on being a pastor was The Reformed Pastor by Richard Baxter. He was one of these Puritan authors. I think of those things when I think of the Puritans. When the world thinks of the Puritans, they think of Cromwell's reforms. You can't go to movies. Kind of, what we would think of puritanical kinds of top-down, strict laws that regulate morality. And that's the reason that Puritans have kind of a bum rap. But we have to remember that they were coming off a time when the Catholics or the Anglicans just ruled everything. Their church canon law ruled society. And so they're kind of duplicating that for good or for worse, for good or for bad. Whereas we are looking back at a time of individual freedom. If you want to be a Christian, you can be, but you express that the way that you want to. If you don't want to be a Christian, you're allowed to live like the devil. And it's not dictated to you by some sort of quasi-religious government. Eventually, Cromwell was offered the crown, but he wanted to establish a true republic, so he refused it. But he did pass on the protectorate to his son, who was less talented than his father, and the whole thing fell apart. And Parliament recalled Charles II from exile, the son of Charles I. They recalled him to take the throne. He had Catholic leanings, and so consequently, he restored the hierarchy, the episcopacy. He restored that sort of church hierarchy along the Archbishop of Canterbury all the way down. And he restored the Book of Common Prayer. and he issued laws against dissidents. So this is the reason that John Bunyan was in jail. Okay, that's the reason that he was in jail. And John Owen also had to go on the run. John Owen was kind of a high church guy. John Bunyan was kind of a low church. He was a Baptist, all right, so kind of a low church guy. And both of them had to, both of them were persecuted. John Owen, an Anglican, had to flee and kind of go into hiding and was under the protection of some powerful nobility. And then John Bunyan gets thrown in jail because he is a dissident against Charles II. On his deathbed, Charles II declared that he himself was a Catholic. His brother, James II, attempted to reestablish Catholicism in Britain. And this was known as the Restoration. So it was the restoration of the monarchy and the restoration of Catholicism. However, Parliament was going to sit still for that. And so they invited William of Orange and his wife, Mary, to come and take over, and they kicked James II out of England. He had to flee to France, and they established a clearly Protestant nation and monarchy. And I guess people were glad it was all over with. So, any comments or questions? I have a couple of lessons that we can learn from this, but you have any comments or questions? In this, what we would look at and just say, what a sorry mix, right? Of and a difficult episode in sort of church history. So here's some lessons that we can talk about. All of this religious infighting, all over Europe, all over Great Britain, all of this leads people to distrust doctrine, to distrust denominational distinctives, and denominational, you know, dogma or doctrine. It led people to trust in reason. Isn't there another way that we can sort of answer the big questions of life? How can we run society? This, well, the answer would be reason. And that leads to sort of some reactions reactions to the Protestant Reformation. One of the reactions is the Catholic reforms and the Council of Trent. Another reaction is rationalism. And another reaction is kind of a spiritualism, kind of an internalization of spiritual things exclusively. I think that, you know, yes, we should care about religion. We should also care about politics. However, I think we should be cautious about how we mix them. We really should be grateful that we have separation of church and state. And we should be very cautious about how we put the stamp of approval of the church on any particular political movement. It seems to have always been a recipe for disaster. So we have to be grateful for the separation here in our own context, and we need to be careful about how we mix religion and politics. And then J.I. Packer, one of my theological heroes, who is an Anglican, he says that the Puritan experiment produced one of the truest expressions of Christianity that has ever existed. And when he says that kind of thing, he's talking about their personal piety and their church reforms and their doctrine. He's not talking about their policies, you know, in general, or specifically Oliver Cromwell's policies. Those are just some... I hope that we can take a week or two to just talk about the Puritans as a church/spiritual movement. Maybe talk a little bit about John Bunyan and John Owen and perhaps some others and see how we have benefited from their studies, from their stands that they took, and from their heritage. But we're not going to focus on their policies, per se. We'll focus on their writings more than anything. Any questions or comments? Go ahead, Don. Right. Indeed it does. Yeah, and there seems to be a progression. We see, especially England, moving already in that direction. So Parliament holding the power of the purse is moving in the direction of the people granting power. But it was it took some convulsions to get there. And ultimately, as we know, Puritan-type people, many of them just left and came to North America and established what we have experienced here in the United States. All right. Any other comments or questions?
You did say that we got the cream of the crop, but you're going to and so forth.
Yes. Yes. Yes, that is very true. Some very diligent thinkers influenced by French Huguenots, by the English Puritans. Even if people like Benjamin Franklin and, oh, now I'm going to forget his, Thomas Jefferson, even if they were not, you know, genuine evangelical Christians who believed in the deity of Christ and the resurrection and those kinds of things, they still had been influenced by these Protestant movements that led up to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. So we have benefited from the religious influence of the we have benefited from the political influence of the Protestant Reformation greatly, probably more than any other society on earth. Last chance. You're dismissed.